Dear Diary, hi, how are you doing? I'm doing fine. But enough about me. How about you? Why don't you ever talk to me, Diary? I expect better things from you. So yeah, my quest to find Mike Tannehill had a bit of a snag today. His former faith is more former than I previously thought. He's really turned against the leaders of the Mormon Church, trying to build up a small army, in fact, to take the Brethren head on. He first tried recruiting his bishop, then his stake president. He tried recruiting people in the church office building. They all told him that they sympathized with his cause, but they could do nothing for him. And he's angry. Really angry. And you don't want to see Mike when he's angry. Because the church that he once loved, with all his heart, might, mind, and strength, had all of these teachings about the way that God blesses righteous people with white skin and curses wicked people with dark skin. And now, that Mormon church is changing their tune to try to be more liberal, along with the philosophies of men, and appeal to a larger crowd. Sellouts. I hope they got more than a bowl full of porridge for selling their birthright like that. So yeah, Mike's foundations are shaking to the core. But only in his view of the so-called prophets and seers and revelators of the Mormon Church, his commitment to maintain those pure, racist doctrines of his youth remain firm, unchanging, unyielding. Do not shrink or shun the fight, brother. I'm Rank McBatten, Faith Detective. And I will find you soon.
Join us now.
Today's episode, The Unintentional Racist, was originally published in March 2014. That's 4 years ago, and a month for those of you keeping track.
Shall the youth of Zion falter
in defending truth and right?
Will the enemy assaileth?
Shall we shrink or shun the fight?
No!
True to the faith that our parents have cherished.
True to the truth for which martyrs have
perished.
To God's command,
soul, heart, and hand,
faithful and true, we were
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today we have a long discussion with Mike Tannehill about his views on the recent essay, Race and the Priesthood, that you can find online at LDS.org. Now, this essay was released by the church in early December 2013, and it addresses head-on the criticism that the Mormon Church is and was a racist organization. Now, it presents a position of equality for all God's children and explains that the seemingly racist priesthood exclusion policy of the past was just a product of culture and human bias rooted in the time in which the church was restored. Now, it's a pretty good essay, actually, especially for those who want to maintain their belief that God directs this church through imperfect people and must therefore restore truth, line upon line, precept on precept, serving milk before meat, yada, yada, yada. But for me, at least, when I really think about it, there's just no satisfactory reason why God would support a racist man-made policy for so long without stepping in at some point and revealing a non-racist message of, I don't know, love, equality, inclusion, you know, something like that to his would-be prophets. And so, if anything, this essay really only exacerbates my concerns in those areas. That's my critique of the essay, at least. But Mike Tannehill... Now, Mike has a few critiques of his own. Now, I'm assuming that most of you already know who Mike is. Mike has been a frequent guest on Mormon Expression and Mormon Expositor and probably a few other Mormon-themed podcasts for about the past 5 years or so. We've spoken to him a few times here on Infants on Thrones as well, and Mike is a lightning rod for controversy. I remember the first time that I heard him on Mormon Expression. I was just yelling at my iPod because he was saying the most ridiculous and unsubstantiated thing about how the Book of Mormon would improve life for an oppressed woman in the Middle East. Now, at least that assertion wasn't blatantly misogynistic, but I do have friends who simply refuse to listen to any podcast episode with Mike Tannehill on it because he constantly supports inflammatory positions. Like just this past week, on Martin Luther King Day, Mike posted some anti-MLK message on his Facebook wall about how we should teach our kids to tell their teachers to go to hell if they try to teach that Martin Luther King was a great American. It's all just part of some anti-American, socialist, liberal agenda. And I'm sure this caused the few dozen of you who haven't already unfriended him to finally pull that trigger and distance yourself from Mike once and for all. But here's the thing. When I look more closely at Mike, I don't think he's really racist. Not intentionally, at least. He's simply a devout, stalwart, valiant Mormon who shall not shrink or shun the fight. Mike is true to the faith that his parents have cherished. He's true to the truth for which martyrs have perished. To God's command, soul, heart, and hand, faithful and true, Mike will ever stand. Mike is exactly what the church machine wanted me to grow up to be. I mean, take a look at 1 Nephi chapter 2, verses 9 through 10. This is Lehi's lament to his two oldest rebellious sons.
Oh, that thou mightest be like unto this river, continually running into the fountain of all righteousness.
Now, this is Mike's validation. It's his marching orders, if you will, for his constant barrage of in-your-face Facebook posts.
Oh, that thou mightest be like unto this valley, firm and steadfast and immovable in keeping the commandments of the Lord.
And this is why Mike can sit on podcast after podcast, being ripped to shreds from every direction, but come out of it chuckling his Mike chuckle, unmoved and completely unfazed. So while the enemy assaileth, who is the enemy here? For Mike, it's liberal ideology. Liberalism is Satan's most devious and effective tool. It erodes stalwart resolution. You want proof? Just listen to this podcast and others like it. Listen to all of the once valiant, now liberal-leaning members who've lost their way. Liberalism is what allows us to become tolerant of sin. It's the fertilizer in which sin blossoms and grows. Liberalism is what allows the satanic camel to stick its nose into your little tent to gain a small respite from the raging storm. Now, you've all heard this Sunday school story, right? You let the camel stick in its nose, and then it wants to bring in its eyes, and then its ears, and then its whole head in, and then its neck, and finally one foot, and then another, until it's completely in your little tent, and you've been completely pushed out, sitting helplessly, unprotected, in the relentless desert storm. Why? All because you showed weakness. You took pity on what you thought was a poor camel stuck in a storm, but what do you have to show for it now? Yeah, I know this isn't exactly if your brother asks you for a cloak, give him your coat also, New Testament feel-good Jesus mumbo-jumbo stuff, but here's the deal. Those damn satanic camels are just out to exploit your kind, liberal-bleeding heart. So you can just take that kind, liberal-bleeding heart and shove it, because that's not real love. Real love is obedience to God's commandments. And God has said to follow the prophet. And the prophets have said some pretty strong things about who gets to have the priesthood and why. So don't start thinking that you can have better answers than what the Lord has already given us through their prophets, because then you're just being liberal and tolerant and you're just letting the camel win. Okay, so you get it? So imagine Mike's grave concern when he reads this essay, Race on the Priesthood, on LDS.org, and saw, liberal ideology that's endorsed by the first presidency themselves. There's this whole white privilege thing in here. It's about equality, and it goes against what it said. It says that doctrines of the past are just theories. Now, look, it's the enemy, and it's assailing it. Shall he shrink or shun the fight? Nope. So fight for the right, Mike. And that's what he did. He made phone calls to his bishop and his state president, to his Area 70. He made phone calls to the very committee that drafted this official church essay. And he's writing a letter right now directly to the first presidency themselves to show them the error of their ways. So don't be confused as you listen to this episode. This isn't really about racism or priesthood or the Abrahamic covenant. It's about what it looks like to be a product of the Mormon belief machine. It's what it looks like when you take all this stuff really, truly, literally. And it's what it looks like when you run into contradictions, and how even the most faithful and resolute member of the church has to pick some things and ignore others and become, to at least some degree, a cafeteria Mormon if they want to survive. And Mike is the perfect, extreme, bombastic example of this. He doesn't try to be or want to be or even admit being a racist. He just unintentionally is one because he has to be, because he's true to the faith. So sit back and enjoy this highly entertaining conversation between myself, Tom Perry.
How do you not have respect for the guy making calls saying this is a bunch of garbage? Dude, I don't know. I love it.
Matt Long.
He's the only one that has the balls to say, come on now, let's embrace the doctrine.
Randy Snyder.
You know who else was like that? Hitler. He really believed in his principles.
Bob Caswell.
Can we splice in like some sort of disclaimer? By the way, whenever Negro is said, it's just Mike.
And Mike Tannehill.
It wasn't just the Negro people that had a priesthood ban.
The unintentional racist.
What the fuck is Mike Tannehill doing on?
Potty mouth.
Where's it?
I go to John's show.
We don't add silly sound effects to cover up our fucks, you fucking fuck.
You're gonna drive away all the members that want to hear this.
No members want to listen to this ever.
So Mike's able to jump on right now because his wife is at Relief Society, and he's able to do this under the radar because she's really...
So don't tell her.
So don't tell. Yeah.
She doesn't listen to the podcast or any
podcast. I get my patriarchy when she's gone.
Yeah. So Randy, just say fuck a lot so that Mike's wife won't listen.
He already did.
But so Mike's got three issues with the recent article on race or the new position in the church on race and the priesthood. So, hey, Mike.
Yes.
Tell us what's going on with this whole race and priesthood thing.
Okay. The church put out an essay the first Friday in December, and it's entitled Race and the Priesthood. And basically, it goes through and at first blush, my just first reading it without examining anything deeply, it says that the church only had the position of withholding the priesthood from the Negro people because of they were bigoted racists and couldn't call down a revelation from heaven to change it until President Kimball was able to get a revelation. And that, to me, was just horrible. And so I just looked at it a little closer, and I've got three real issues with it. Do you want me to go through them?
Yeah.
If they're short and concise, you bet.
Okay, the first one is that they use the phrase white privilege to say that the reason for the ban was because, you know, racism, America's a racist country, blah, blah, blah. White privilege comes from what's known as critical race theory. Critical race theory comes up out of the civil rights movement, and those who didn't think the civil rights movement went far enough really wanted to ingrain the theory that white people are racist and all this into the American legal system. And so that you see the phrase white privilege popping up around to say that America's always been racist and our laws have always held black people down. This is a quote from Emory Law Professor Dorothy Brown. She says, by using things like white privilege and critical race theory, they seek to highlight the ways in which the law is not neutral and objective, but designed to support white supremacy and subordination of people of color in America. And this whole theory that's, you know, it's coming up through the colleges and through the police systems across America that we're racist and we should all be ashamed of ourselves for our heritage and do what we can to help black people. And for that to be in a church publication, the phrase white privilege is just outrageous. It's a political liberal terminology. If you look at the ones that built up critical race theory, they're radicals. And for them to use that in church publication says something about the authors. Now, the First Presidency did not write the essay. They had a committee do it. And they just kind of signed off on these essays. And I don't think they understood that that was in there. But once you see that it's in there, it peppers the entire essay.
So why does it bother you that white privilege is in there, that it's a political word?
It's a totally political word. It's a radical thing. And it has no business in a church publication.
So if you were to, let's say they said, okay, Brother Tannehill, why don't you rewrite it for us? How would you frame it? What would be your solution to that?
That's my point number three.
Okay.
Number two.
Yeah.
Is that towards the end of the essay, they're dismissive. They say they disavow all theories, how do they phrase it, regarding all the different things about black people that came up in the Mormon church until the ban came along. The problem is they mention some things that aren't theories, they're actually doctrines. Like they mention that the darkening of skin color is a theory. But How many verses in Scripture can you name, especially in the Book of Mormon, that spells out it's not a theory, God did that?
Right.
There's Moses 7:22, Abraham 1:27, 2 Nephi 5:21, 3 Nephi 2:15, Alma 3:6-9. And then they talk about the theory that they couldn't marry into the Negro race, that members of the church shouldn't marry. Now, that had to do, it was a general ban in the church members to not marry outside the priesthood, Negro or otherwise. But if the Negroes didn't have the priesthood, that's what the ban was there for.
Well,
you're supposed
to
marry someone who has a priesthood.
Okay, but I mean, I think they're two separate issues, aren't they? I mean, yeah, they were encouraged to marry within the priesthood or whatever. But I think there was this emphasis on the racism thing, I think. That's the interpretation I get.
No, that ties into Moses 8 that says the reason the flood came about is because all the church members married outside the church and everyone became wicked.
Now, there were church leaders that made specific references to race.
They did.
So it wasn't necessarily about, well, make sure that he's a priesthood holder.
Well, yeah.
I think you're using that as kind of a straw man there. You're saying,
if none of the Negroes could hold a priesthood, then you don't marry any Negroes, correct? Until the ban was lifted, and then they don't care anymore.
So you're saying they use that as like a cover? Like they're saying... Well,
it's just to say these things are theories and disavow the theories and then name off things that are canonized scripture, you can't do that.
Well,
you can't disavow canon. And the third one is Tom touched on, is that there is doctrine behind priesthood bans. It wasn't just the Negro people that had a priesthood ban. You remember the Levites could only officiate in certain things. There were very few actual Melchizedek priesthood holders.
Okay.
You know, God comes down from the mountain and wipes out the priesthood from among the general Israelite population.
So what does that have to do with what? Okay, so there was. Okay, we can we go ahead and say, oh, okay, fine. What does that have to do with the racism ban, though?
If he can limit it to just the Levites, he can limit it to just the non-darkies.
It has to do with family lines.
It's more complex. Okay.
Okay. You notice, you remember the Jacob's allegory of the olive trees, where he's quoting an older Book of Mormon prophet that we don't have. I think it's Zezram.
Zenas, the lawyer,
had the allegory of the olive trees. What do the trees in the garden represent?
The house of Israel.
Okay, one is the house of Israel.
One is the, and the other
the one
is the
they're
Gentiles.
Tending to, and they have, and the others are the Gentiles, yeah. And the other family trees,
and the wickedness.
And some of them are tended to.
There's grafting.
Okay, and so the grafting represents when they bring in the Gentiles into the priesthood line. Which doesn't happen. Remember, Christ wouldn't teach Gentiles during his lifetime. It was only after he died He sent a revelation to Peter. Okay, now you can bring the Gentiles in. It's just families come into the priesthood at different times, and that God distributes his authority as he sees fit. If he didn't do it to the Negroes, so 78, then that's his option.
So so God sees fit, Ren, right? I mean,
remember, this is, I mean, the way that we've talked about the Book of Mormon before is being an example of pseudepigrapha, where Joseph Smith is assuming the voice of ancient prophets, and in this case, it's an ancient prophet who never actually existed. And so we've got a brand new allegory that's conveniently explaining how a branch of Gentiles, like Joseph Smith and the early saints, could be grafted into the pure and original priesthood that came from Israel. So it's this really convenient pseudepigraphical explanation that justifies this whole Mormon movement.
Wait, Gentiles being brought in is a New Testament thing. It's not a Joseph Smith thing.
Well, okay, I'm not saying he came up with the idea, but he's the one that created the Zenus character and gave it that weight in the Book of Mormon. That's my assertion.
I think the funniest thing about this is that the mortal Jesus was a racist, but the resurrected Jesus was not. So
you got to replace the word racism with families. All right.
I'm calling a spade, man.
Right. Funny. The thing that interests me the most about what's going on. Come on, guys. The thing that interests me the most about this is the way that Mike is taking on the church. You know that, Mike, you've been called an apostate by
you.
Well, not by I've been doing that for a long time, but I mean the who was it? The church committee. So talk about who you've talked to, who you've raised these issues with, and what those conversations have been like.
All right. The thing was popping up on my screen for over the weekend, and I just ignored it, and then I'm like, okay, I'll read this thing. And so the night I read it, I went to my bishop and said, "You got to read this. This is absolute garbage." And they can't have this up on the LDS website. This is wrong. This is faith-destroying. It's heresy. And so I got them to read it, and I talked to them on the following Sunday, and they agreed with me, yeah, it's crap.
Bishop agreed that it was crap?
Yeah, he's like, oh, what a bunch of garbage.
He agreed with all three of your points about it?
To my memory, yeah, he did.
Okay.
So I couldn't get a hold of my steak because things were – it was over the holidays, really. But I did, as soon as the holidays were over, like first week of January, I called my 70. And I called him and said, can you read this and look at these things? He said, sure. He called my 70, called me back that night, and we went over him. He sees wiggle room with the thing where it says theories. And I'm like, they can't play with speech like that.
He's a 70, Mike.
But he saw my points.
But he made wiggle room, though. He essentially said, oh, come on, Mike.
Well, he said, this is from the brethren. You know, the brethren signed off on it. It's signed off on.
Well, because, I mean, I guess that they would be expecting that you would sustain the brethren. And here you're challenging them, and you're saying that this is heresy that they came up with and put on their LDS.org website.
But the brethren did not write this. They had a committee write it. And
but
who
they
knows?
Approved it, though.
Do they write anything, Mike? Mike, when was the last time the brethren wrote anything, like since like Joseph Fielding Smith? It's been by committee forever.
They write their talks at conference.
Really? I don't think so.
They're heavily what's the word I'm looking for?
Unless you're Packer.
Redacted by a committee.
I'll say what I want if you're Packer. But I just Googled LDS.org and looked for intellectual reserve, I think is what they're called.
Right.
And I called their headquarters and talked to a couple people there. He says, we're getting flooded with calls over this same essay. He says, I don't like it either, is what the guy told me. And so I called, I found out through them that it's the church history department had to do with this because it's a church history project. They're releasing a whole bunch of essays over these topics, and what they've done is they just sent out to a bunch of intellectuals to pool together and write these essays.
Were any of the intellectuals also feminists and or homosexuals?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think the most important question here is, Mike, are you willing, if the people that agree with you see fit to make you their leader, to break off and to start your own fundamentalist group?
I can't even organize my own podcast. You think I'm going to do a branch off of the church?
I don't know. I think through the internet, you wield a lot of power.
You got a lot of clout. I just love that you can joke about it, Mike. That makes my day that you're not like, you know, frustrated or really nervous or because most people would be not in a position to talk about stuff like this so openly. And I really admire that about you because this is serious business. And my theory here is that everyone's playing each other because it seems like every time you've told me how somebody feels about it, they're giving you like the diplomatic answer of like, oh yeah, I agree with you, but my hands are tied. And then you call somebody up, oh yeah, I agree with you, but my hands are tied. And like, I think it's just that most people have a certain sense of apathy when it comes to the church having to comply with modern standards of civic sort of things, and they just do this over and over again. And you're the only one who's like, "Hang on, guys, back the truck up. What are we doing?"
You know what, Mike? It's time. It's time for you to pull out your javelin and make things right.
Oh, my javelin. So, but Mike, didn't you get into kind of a yelling match with one of these guys from one of these intellectuals?
Yeah, I two of the higher ups at Church History Department. One guy was Tom, and I think the other guy was Craig or something. I can't remember exactly. But they're like, well, you got to support the brethren. You can't just – and I'm like, wait a minute. White privilege is a political term. You can't use that in church publication. And he tried to tell me it's not a political term. But if you – a simple Google will tell you who wrote critical race theory, where it came from, the radical organizations they spin off of. You know, white privilege is just another way of saying critical race theory. And he's trying to tell me it's not a political term. And I'm like, also, what am I supposed to do? Rip Alma chapter 3 out of my scriptures? Or Alma chapter 3 directly defies your essay.
And he agreed with you. Is that right? He agreed with you.
He did. He said, you go ahead and rip that out. Just he was laughing as he said it. But it was heated at that point, we're just screaming at each other over the phone.
Incidentally, did anyone else grow up in the Mormon church with seminary teachers recommending that you staple Songs of Solomon shut in the Bible because it's useless and it's kind of apocryphal and it's not...
My bishop president said just rip it out.
Yeah, see? So yeah. It's not like this is unprecedented. It's just it's the Book of Mormon instead of the Bible.
But okay, Mike, I got to ask you, so it sounds to me like the conversation turned from this race issue into criticizing the brethren issue, because it sounds like every time you'd run into somebody, they said, you got to obey the brethren.
That's exactly right. The two uppity ups at History Department were like that. They're like, you can't defy the brethren.
So Mike,
whether it come from my mouth or from my servants, it is the same.
So, Mike, I guess the real question is where do you get the size of balls to go and call all these people and essentially criticize the brethren? I mean, you go to your 70. I mean, you're doing pretty profound things as far as like an average believing Mormon goes. I mean, I don't see a lot of Mormons that would have the size of balls that you have to go and say, well, I'm going to make some phone calls and really try to set the record straight here.
I snuck into my wife's, you know, at night while she was still sleeping and took them out of her purse. And then I went and hung a bunch of phone calls. And I just got some phone numbers. I know some people online got me actually one of the author's names and phone numbers. I was actually able to talk to one of the committee members that wrote it.
Wait, wow. you were saying that you snuck those balls out of your wife's purse?
Yes.
Yeah. Have you returned them to her? I guess she's wearing them right now. If she's
check them in and out.
She's out at Relief Society, and that's why you're...
It's like a library card, and I just...
Yeah. Here's what I love about this. Mike is me in 2007 when Prop 8 and Prop 102 in Arizona came out, when I said, the brethren are wrong. Yeah. This is wrong.
Yeah. I've got scripture
to
back up my position.
Right, sorry. Your fake scripture isn't any more authoritative than my fake scripture. No. But you're doing the same thing. You had the same reaction. What you're saying is your personal stance on morality or doctrine is different than the brethren, so you're going to go with your own. So good for you, Mike.
But Mike's not saying it's his personal. He's saying that this is church doctrine. This is what's being swept away.
Well, the one guy that I talked to, the author, and I mentioned the white privilege thing, he knew exactly what I was talking about. And he said, well, what do you mean? It's not just a theory. White privilege is real. And you're going, what the hell are you talking about? This is a radical liberal ideology theory that's being pushed, and you're trying to use it to back up your stance on this church history essay?
So, Mike,
you can't say those things.
So after you talked with these guys at the history department, then you talked with your stake president, right?
I talked to one of his counselors because he was out of town.
Okay. And how did that go?
He said, well, I didn't get that when I read it. And I said, well, go back and look for these things. And I haven't talked to him about it since then, but he knows what I'm doing. And I got two-thirds of my letter to the presidency written. It's a rough draft. I got to edit it and write the last part. And then I'm hoping what I want to do is go to my bishop and my stake and my 70 and have them just say, please look at what he's saying. You know, not that we agree with him, but just please review these things so that when it appears before the 12, it's not just some yucko in the stick sending him a letter.
Mike, I have a question. If they don't change their stance on this, would you leave the church?
No, I just won't sustain the essay. Well, you know, it's the essay that's wrong, and I don't know which.
So
of the 12
you'll
it.
You'll become a cafeteria Mormon.
Oh. Okay, so Mike, you know, let's see. How old are you now?
42.
So in 30 years, when you're 72, and the church accepts gay marriage, maybe not in the temple, but just accepts gay marriage. I mean, Mike, you should have seen the writing on the wall. I mean, the church has loosened its stance on birth control, on women's rights, on, you know, blacks in the priesthood. The church changes with social, you know, outside social pressures. It's just the way it's been. You know, polygamy. They should.
I have
it
a good authority that the 12 have pounded the pulpit that gay marriage is never going to be accepted.
Yeah, and they'll be dead
until they die.
All of them will be dead in 30 years, Mike, and you'll be 72.
Do you see Holland accepting it?
Holland will be dead in less like 10 years.
But I mean, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But you certainly had apostles pounding the pulpit about race and the priesthood
and birth control. It wasn't that long ago that apostles and oral sex is no longer taboo in the Mormon church.
I got a copy of that Kimball letter. I got it on my computer.
Yeah, but they don't touch it now.
So, Mike, is this the first time for you, or what's different? Like, because Randy just listed, like, literally five examples that for me are, like, practically the same thing. But for you, this is the one that's setting you off, but all the other ones are okay?
I sustain the brethren on their stance on gay marriage.
Well, I think the difference is this one's
what
happening.
What about on oral sex?
This one's happening on Mike's clock. It's like when he's in the prime of his life, and he's been used to it for 42 years, and now it's like, what the fuck just happened? Whereas in the past, like, you just read about all the stuff about oral sex and birth control. That was before your time, and then you just sort of, you know, sign off on it because it's not your problem. It's that you didn't have to deal with it front and center like this one. Is that what it is?
I just, this one's so obviously in your face wrong that, you know, what else can you do?
But because you're so used to it the right way. But the other ones, you were never used to it the right way. It was just history books.
So what do you think is going on, Mike? I mean, do you think the church is or this committee is trying to popularize the church or, you know, liberalize or make it more progressive? I mean, what's happening here? Is there something
it's hard to say?
To?
I don't know what the approval process was. I don't know how much of this they read, or, you know, did they all sit in a circle and read it as the 12 and read this essay and say, okay, cool, we'll all sign off on this? Or was it just, you know, one of the guys at the end of the night on his way out the door, hey, can you sign off on the essays the history department put out? Oh, sure. You know,
from what I understand is if they give approval, it doesn't matter whether it's short term or if they're just like, oh, you need a signature, I'll sign it. The Lord is inspiring them. And wouldn't the Lord?
No, actually, it doesn't work that way. The 12 don't stand around in a deluge of revelation all day long.
But if they're approving something that's important that has their stamp of approval, you think the Lord's going to be like, nah, I'll just let that one slide. I won't intervene there.
He'll strike them dead.
But isn't this race in the priesthood clarification on LDS.org part of a larger series of the church addressing problematic issues? I mean, isn't there one on polygamy, and there's one they're adding other ones? So I mean,
first
what
vision.
Is this? Yeah, so, yeah, they did the multiple versions of the first vision. So what's happening? Are they just trying to placate the masses? How do you see this movement in general, Mike?
Well, they've been doing a lot of stuff with the history department. They're putting out, like, everything Joseph Smith ever wrote and big deluxe format. And, you know, there's all this history stuff coming out because they got, like, an army down there digging through the archives finding fascinating things.
Because it turns out Google isn't going away. And people, I don't mean to be, you know, snide about it. It's people are finding it, and the kids in particular, youth, you know, I call it the generation under ours, but it's not my kids. It's kind of the space between me and my kids. Those guys who are now kind of going on missions are finding this stuff, and it's destroying them. The number of kids that are leaving the church that from my home ward. I mean, are almost everyone but one of a certain generation have. And it's because of this. And so I think it's really more about being pragmatic. And they're also losing converts with this.
What makes me want to cry?
So when somebody gets some missionaries at their door, they teach them the first discussion. Then they go online and Google, and they're done.
Right.
What made me want to cry is one of those kids looking up Race in the Priesthood and saying, oh, they can never call down a revelation because they were all racist bigots. Not until Kimball. Oh, what kind of church is this? Because that's what it's saying.
But you're right, Mike. You are 100% right. And that's what I said when I read it. I had a friend of mine who's a former bishop, who is a member of the High Council, came to me and said, "You know about this stuff seems like more than I do. Doesn't this say that they're all just racist bigots and they didn't have revelation then?" I said, that's how I wrote it. So I'm interested that a former bishop and current high council member read it the same way. So you're absolutely right, Mike.
Now, I know for a fact McKay could receive revelation. How many testimonies did his secretary have where he'd come back from the temple about praying about a new apostle and his physical, like Moses, was a testimony? You know, McKay could get an answer from the Lord when he wanted one. And he prayed over this very issue multiple times.
How do you know? You're giving an example that's unfalsifiable. He picked the right guy. How do we fucking know that? You're saying that's proof that he gets revelation.
The people that worked with him is that his face glowed like Moses when he got back from the temple for praying about an apostle to call.
Testimonials and anecdotal evidence are a recipe for promoting bullshit.
Well, all I'm saying is to say that the actual essay says he got no answer when he prayed about it.
But Hubie Brown did, and it turns out Hubie Brown was right.
No, Hubie Brown is
everything.
But Mike, you think that McKay and others did get the answer, and the answer was
not now.
God was saying it's not time yet. Just be patient.
Right. And the number, I mean, McKay and,
your assertion, Mike, right, is that the ban on the priesthood wasn't about racism as part of the culture that these men were living in, that it was really God who was holding it for his own wisdom.
That's why I say waiting. You got to replace the word race with family, and it makes perfect sense and lines up with the Abrahamic covenant and all these other things.
What about the Brazilians?
What about
It wasn't in like the Fijians, but anyway.
No, the Brazilians were very complex.
No, the Brazilians. It was initially Brazilians were out, but then it turned out that, well, we've already kind of started down this road, and so we're going to come up with this arbitrary 1/16 on your father's side because it was the cat was already out of the bag, the toothpaste was out. So. I mean, they had that principle. They had that. They applied that at one point, and then said, "Meh, fuck the napkin."
The napkin?
Come on, Mike. It's a Spinal Tap reference.
Oh, sorry. But I know there's a big issue with the Cubans as well. I know there's a letter sent to the presidency about the Cubans, and there was a big to do back in the day when they wanted to take the gospel into Cuba.
So Mike, why was God withholding it from the families, and family is better than race?
Well, what is the blessing of the Abrahamic covenant to a married couple?
Don't play that game. Just tell us.
This applies because the blessing is that your children will always either hold the priesthood or have it made available to them. The opposite of that, which is the curse, is that you're cut off. They refer to them in the scriptures as the people of the half-empty baskets because they're not going to be able to pick any fruit from the tree. You see what I'm saying? There's no blessings of the gospel in their family.
So is the atonement of Christ then dead for those people because they didn't have...
The priesthood can actually become a curse if you have the priesthood and then you don't live up to the responsibilities. All the blessings of the priesthood are reversed.
Oh, so the dark-skinned people weren't ready to live up to it yet.
The culture they lived in would not sustain a righteous person. Just like in the days of Noah, God had to...
They're in America. Black people were in America.
in the
60s. What about Africa?
I don't really want
Africa
to go down
this
path.
Africa to this day is full of warlords.
the church wasn't even in fucking Africa. It was in America.
This goes back to the days of Noah.
Yeah.
That doesn't even make sense. That doesn't even matter.
All right, go ahead, Matt.
To be doctrinal, don't you have to so is your premise that you attribute the curse to Ham? Is that your... Well,
you got your scriptures handy? This is a Mormon podcast, right? You should all have your scriptures next to your microphones.
I usually have it on my iPad. No, this is good. I like this. I want to do this.
Moses 7:22.
Are we talking about Egyptus and Egyptus?
No, this is goes back to... well, yeah, it actually ties into that. And Enoch also beheld the residue of the people which were the sons of Adam, and they were a mixture of all the seed of Adam, save it were the seed of Cain, for the seed of Cain were black and had not place among them. All right, and Noah's son married one of the daughters of Cain, which brought the skin through.
Who was Egyptus?
But the curse came because Ham tried to steal the priesthood from his father. He stole garment patterns. No, he didn't have sex with him. He stole the garment and tried to make copies of it, and then he gave a false version of the priesthood to his family, which leads to Abraham.
Wait. The book of Abraham talks about the markings on the garments and that Ham tried to copy the Masonic markings from the garments.
Nope. But he did give a false version of the priesthood to his children, Abraham 1:27.
What's the source of this? The whole garment thing?
Apocryphal scripture.
Okay.
Isn't false priesthood?
Nibley quotes it in Temple and Cosmos. Uh-huh. He quotes it the whole thing.
Yeah. Okay.
I got a really important question, Mike.
Okay.
What changed in Africa from the time of McKay in the 60s to 1978 that made them ready?
Because the civil rights movement had happened, and they were all fully accepted as...
You mean the civil rights movement that the Brethren fought tooth and nail against, saying it was a communist plot?
It was a tool of the communists.
Yes, it was a communist plot to overthrow capitalism.
I remember hearing
capitalism.
About that.
What? Have you heard of M.F. Benson, Harold B. Lee, and...
Benson, Lee,
and there was someone else.
Joseph Fielding Smith. Harold B. Lee and Joseph Fielding Smith, the two that came after David O. McKay.
And Bruce R. McConkie.
Yeah.
All right.
It was actually, wasn't it that Stanford refused to play BYU in football? And that's what ultimately
I think that had more to do with it than Abraham and Covenant. But the funny thing is that Mormons like Mike can now rewrite history and say the civil rights movement was a good thing when all of their heroes fought against it.
But at the end of the day, Mike's right. Mike is right.
About
what this says about the church generally, that revelation just – there is no revelation, that all these guys that came before were so wrong on such a fundamental point that you should ignore everything else they said, just like Adam God, just like everything else they've ever said.
Yeah, okay. All right.
And that's the message it sends to members, and that's what Mike's fighting against, I think. And so good for him.
So is this Mike
to be doing it?
Hey, Mike, is this your last appearance on Infants?
I'm happy to show up whenever you want me.
Aw. So I have a question for you, Mike. How did it work, or how does it work, if blacks and whites are segregated because God wanted it that way? How does he define blacks and whites? Like, do you have a formula? Is there an accurate, like... You know, is it 1/16? Is it mother's side, father's side? Where's the magic thing? Where is it documented? Because we're talking about it as if like there's two races in the world, and really like everyone loves to fuck, and everyone's just brown here. So
yeah,
what about the
Romanian and Bulgarian gypsies? Where do they fall down?
Now this is where you actually apply McConkie's quote that it doesn't matter anymore properly. Is that since that time there's no priesthood restriction, and you can marry however you want to marry. It doesn't matter.
But it did matter back then.
It did matter then because they did not have the priesthood, and you have to have the priesthood in your family.
That's a Jedi mind trick. There's nothing to see here. Everything's fine, and nothing matters.
They're misquoting McConkie in the essay. They stumble and stupidly use his phrase. They don't quote him. They don't use his name, but they're saying the same thing, but they're twisting it in a way that's improper.
But was that ever a formula? Was there ever a magic formula? Because nobody in their right mind believes that there are pure white and pure black people, and if there are, it's like an anomaly. It's a minority. Like, there's always some white and some black in everyone. So, like, where does that leave everyone? Is there how do you document this for all those cases where it's mixed when this was actually happening?
I have no idea.
Okay,
it'll all make sense in the millennium.
It's just like temple work. It's like it doesn't make any sense, but it will someday.
Okay.
Well, even those that never had the priesthood, they're judged according to what they did with the light of Christ that was in them. And so,
let me ask this: if it's about priesthood and it's always about priesthood, then why were black females not allowed to participate in the temple?
I'm sure that.
That
was the one that she actually crossed the plains from Nauvoo and came to Salt Lake and settled.
No. Not just her. I'm saying black women were not allowed to participate in the temple. That happened in conjunction with the priesthood. And they keep talking about a priesthood band. And that suggests, though, that it was more than that. It was a racist doctrine. It was a racist practice, rather. So why do we keep focusing on the priesthood? If that's true, how do we reconcile that?
Because their ordinances of the priesthood. Well, I guess they could be baptized, but they couldn't be exalted. When you go through the temple and you go through the endowment session, you're talking about doing work to make you exalted. And so they were cut off from that.
So let me continue this out. You'd agree with me doctrinally. Those that are baptized but are not sealed do have a certain role in heaven. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Right. Mormon theology really has no hell. We have outer darkness and three heavens.
No. But if you're baptized and if you're actually valiant and you're saved to the point where you are baptized but not not sealed, you have a certain role to those who are sealed. That's true, isn't it, Mike?
You are. Yeah, is that in D&C 76?
132.
About your servants unto the Most High?
Is that what these men were trying to create then?
Well, anybody that is not exalted becomes a servant. I mean,
ouch, damn. So this now becomes even more racist than I originally thought.
It doesn't just happen to the Negro people, it happens to everyone. If you're not exalted, you become a servant.
But they don't even have an opportunity.
It's if you don't enter into the new and everlasting covenant.
Correct.
Ouch.
Section 132.
That's everybody, just blacks.
What about the pre-existence? Like, are those that are 1/16th black? Is it directly proportional? like, were you 1/16th less valiant in the is it a 1-to-1 ratio?
No. That is actually, when they refer to that as a theory in the essay, they're correct, because you can only tie that to two scriptures, and one is in Abraham when he talks about the what's the way he phrases it, to the noble and great ones. So sure. You know, if there were noble and great ones, there were less noble and great ones. That makes sense. Then you tie that into D&C, I want to say it's in 88, where it talks about like clings to like, and he goes in through like five verses about how equal things cling together and stay together and everything's given a law. So
right.
you can assume that groups of people clung together, and that's how family groups came to earth.
Yeah.
Whatever group you most associated with and were most like stayed together. And so they're making an assumption based on those scriptures that if they were cut off from the priesthood, that must be how they all were in the pre-existence.
And so that's not racist?
It's a theory. I mean, that applies to, that's not just the Negroes, that's all people. That's all family lines. You can't just say it's just them.
So is there any other, are other... Give me some more examples of other races that are in this same category. Because you keep trying to generalize it away as if, like, you would say family instead.
Anything you can say about Negroes in 1978, you can say about Gentiles at the time of Peter when he received his revelation. Because all the Gentiles from Noah to Peter were cut off.
Well, that's not true, because they're this hybrid. It's not like no, you can't teach them. If that was the case, then your analogy would make sense. But this is this hybrid of, yes, you can baptize them, yes, they can be in the church, but what they can't have is this peace which grants some sort of
right
part of our hierarchy, part of the authority to make them really equal with everyone else. And that's what makes it racist, Mike. It's that your analogy is just false.
Right, it's not like, it's like you can get partway there. It's like, you know, there was a huge portion of the church's history where they could participate, but only in certain specific ways. And it's the old school model of the Gentiles was all or nothing, right? It's like, don't even talk to them, don't even teach them. So what is this middle ground that is racism that isn't the Gentile model.
Well, I know, in America, they could get baptized, but in Africa, they wouldn't even send people to go baptize them, would they? Am I wrong in that, or am I correct in how I'm remembering that?
Well, I want to go back to what you said, though, about the time of the Gentiles and with Peter, because even at that time, a certain tribe of Israel had the priesthood? The priesthood wasn't available to every Jew.
The higher priesthood, yeah. The lesser priesthood was among the Levites, and there were a few high priests, but, yeah, in general, they couldn't.
So you weren't even talking about a priesthood ban there.
Well, it was a partial priesthood ban. They were cut off from the higher priesthood.
Well, they were just cut off from everything.
No, DNC 84 gets into it.
Whatever.
I can tell you, my dad served his mission in Mexico City from 1960 to 1962, and he did have a directive that if he came across a black person, that he just don't even bother teaching them. And it wasn't because there was an all or nothing. It was that they just didn't want to have to deal with finding out how much black was in that person. And I got to tell you, my dad did not have a racist bone in his body, and he hated this doctrine all the way up until 1978 when he celebrated.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a huge relief when it went through. Everybody was very excited.
Yeah, because they were finally like, oh, my God isn't more racist than me. Finally.
But even keeping to Mike's assumption that racism matters and it's bigger and it's not racism and it's families and we convolute the definition and expand it and make it all lovely, white, and delightsome, why does it matter? Maybe we don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but I just want to know from Mike's perspective, why does God care about, like, why is that part of the plan that he has all these different groups of people that are different colors and have different blood, and then therefore they have different critical paths to get back to heaven? And actually now in the 20th and 21st century, it doesn't matter anymore, but it did really in the past. And like, why does that what does that have to do with anything? Why is that part of the plan of salvation? Like the rest of it, I get the Mormon plan of salvation. It, you know, logistically, I can see how it could make sense to some people, but this whole like, different races at different points of time. Like, what is God thinking? What's the deal?
Well, way back when, the world was a lot smaller place, and you're dealing with family groups and tribes, and you're trying to preserve one to be holy and sanctified.
Why? Who cares?
It's the plan of salvation.
But these black people were integrated into Western culture long before 1978.
Right.
Why did it take until 1978 for them to say, now they're ready?
Well, you get into like
how long, Mike, how long do you think the sanctity of these family groups was preserved before God threw in the towel and he's like, fuck it, they're all intermingling.
In the Old Testament. You see in the Old Testament where they go wicked and he drives them off and the ten tribes are scattered.
It's all less than one generation, man. It's like, if that was his plan, like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, why would he have a plan that you needed sanctified, pure family groups to link back in a chain, but separate from each other, but they all are on the earth? Like, what is that? Like, what does that have to do with anything? How does that factor into the plan of salvation on a personal level for you and me and for individuals going back to heaven? Why does that matter?
Well, I can tell you that if your ancestors were members of the church, they have rights to call on in the Abrahamic covenant for you to be blessed and put in positions of authority to challenge you and make you to grow. And I mean, just look, for example, in the Book of Mormon story, the Lamanites were cursed. They wipe out the Nephites, who were the righteous. And then so God makes it so that the Gentiles come and wipe them out. And then they're blessed with Christianity here in America.
But doesn't that go against one of the articles of faith that children won't be punished for the sins of their parents?
No, because that article of faith only is just dealing with infant baptism and how the Catholics say if your baby's not baptized, he's going to hell because of the fall. That's what that was about. But God,
to me, it says
the entire scriptural canon talks about how God deals with families, and some are cursed and some are blessed. That's everything you read in the scriptures is talking about.
That's right.
That's profoundly unjust.
It doesn't make sense.
It talks about it like as a document that we accept as an aggregate form of historical things that might have happened. But like, what does that have to do with doctrinal? Like, I don't think, even as an active believing Mormon before I left the church, Mike, like the Abrahamic covenant and what tribe was this? Like, it just, even then, I just brushed it aside because I had no idea. There was, like, no relevancy at all. Like, it didn't make any sense. It was just a relic of the past. And I still, to this day, have never understood why it matters, because it's not practical in any sense of how the plan of salvation works.
Well, it's to me, it did matter, Bob, but I had like the Elder Price complex where I knew that I was destined for incredible things and that I had come through an incredible bloodline with incredible blessings, and that, you know, I was of the tribe of Ephraim, which meant God had chosen me and put me in this, you know, like Mike referenced earlier in the book of Abraham, the noble and great ones and the pre-existence, preordained to be a light unto the entire world and to raise everyone else up out of the dust.
Why can't I be as eloquent as you, Glenn?
Seriously.
I love it, Glenn.
That was
beautiful.
That was like that whole elitist, and we've had this argument before, Mike, that the elitist view that made me feel special and better than everybody else, that I started looking at and going, whoa, I don't want to be that douchebag. Once I started realizing that, I'm like, that is so douchey. I don't like that.
Well, that's because if you're part of that covenant, you're the worker. You're the one that has to go out and do the work and do the job and bring the light of the gospel to people and bring them into the covenant.
But anybody can be part of the covenant. It doesn't matter anymore. Like, it's not a prerequisite to do anything.
And the reason why is because that blood of Ephraim got scattered amongst all the people, and so they fell under the power of the covenant.
It's a way of making you feel special. If you can trace your blood back to these noble, great, you know, I mean, people do it now with Ancestry, where they're like, oh, I paid $25 to who's who in my ancestry and found out that I'm related to Charlemagne.
Yeah, but that's convoluting, look, okay, two things. Like, one thing is, I'm proud of my ancestry and look what my ancestors did. But then it's taking it to a whole other level when it's like, therefore, this is justification for God's almighty wisdom of segregation and bringing people. Like, it still doesn't. I mean, Glenn's argument only makes sense if we just admit that this is all man-made and it's just a self-reflection of man's preoccupation with himself.
But it's not the entire script. The entire scriptural canon, Bible, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, is all about this thing. And this is my point number three. Is that by writing this essay and putting out the crap that's in it, they've missed a huge teaching moment. The fact that we're having this conversation is because this hasn't been taught clearly enough, and they missed a huge opportunity here to explain, you know, that God operates through families, and there's a reason and a purpose behind priesthood bands and priesthood blessings, and this is a teaching moment, and they blew it.
Yeah, well, that's
because they would have lost converts if they take that position, Mike. They lose converts.
This ties in directly when Moroni appeared in Joseph Smith's bedroom. He says, "Now is the time of Elijah, where turn the hearts of the fathers to children, the children of the fathers." That's what all this is about.
But Mike, you know that didn't really happen, right?
Of course, it happened.
You mean the Moroni with the white chest and the white hair and the white robe? That Moroni?
No. Not only that, Bob. You could see through his robe and see his breast. He was not wearing garments, bitch.
Oh, brother.
Garments hadn't been conceived of at that point.
That's,
I mean,
true.
This is the title page of the Book of Mormon.
Why would he not be wearing garments? I don't know. I understand. Don't garments go back to the ancient Solomon temples?
Maybe the robe was the garment, Randy.
There you
Have you
go.
Ever thought of that?
Oh,
why don't you think of that?
I didn't hear Joseph mention any markings on the robe.
He just didn't know.
Glenn, I love how you answer things exactly like yourself of 10 years ago. It's like beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're good at channeling yourself.
Stick to that thought pattern, Glenn.
Yeah.
This title page of the Book of Mormon, to remind the house of Israel who their fathers were and the promises made to them so they can take hold of them and operate through that priesthood that's in their lineage that they have a right to.
But nowadays, nobody has a right to anything based on their lineage. Like, that is such an antiquated, like, nobody adheres to that.
To
Mormonism,
you?
Not just to me, to anyone in affiliated with Mormonism, there's no relevance to, you know, everybody gets...
That's a pretty sweeping statement, Bob.
Really?
You're baptized. Yeah. Baptized, yeah. You get a patriarchal blessing, and you find out what your job is.
Okay, so Patriarchal blessing is optional for one, and for two, let's say you get that piece of useless, batshit, crazy information in it that says you're part of the tribe that everyone else is a part of, Ephraim. What does that mean? It means nothing. It doesn't change how you act as a Mormon day to day. It doesn't
change. Wait. More importantly, those who have been identified as the other tribes, what do they do differently than what everybody that's Ephraim does?
Right.
Nothing.
No, that actually, you're going to find in the Old Testament manuals this area in your Sunday school, if you go, that there's a whole lesson on what the different tribes' jobs are.
That's
our problem is we're not going.
I have a lot of friends who were Manasseh because they were islanders, and there was some patriarch at some point believed that they had to identify them as Manasseh. Notwithstanding that other people were also identified as Ephraim, but what's the job that the Manasseh tribe does versus different than
I'd
what
have
we
to look
do?
It up. I got a book around here that has it in
but
it.
But Mike, if it's so important to God to have this family lineage, name one time in your life where you've talked to somebody, like you should have it on the tip of your tongue. This person, my ward, is this tribe and he does this. This person is this tribe and he does that. You don't know the tribe of anybody. You barely know the tribe of yourself, probably, and your wife.
Where are you from?
Ephraim. Okay.
Like everyone else.
Exactly. Like, what does it matter? Like, if that's the structure of God's church and it's the same as it was back then, as it is today, all that good stuff, like, where is the significance? Where is that in the day-to-day operational, everybody has a different job to do because of their tribe sort of thing? I don't see it at all.
Well, Ephraim's job is to proclaim the gospel and bring them into the covenant.
That's the job of everyone in the church. There's nothing that says, you're a part of Manasseh, you don't need to go on a mission, you don't need to proselyte, you're done.
Every member a missionary.
Yeah. It's all one tribe, Mike. There's no like significance to families in that way. Like, it doesn't. I'm just still struggling with why this mattered, other than.
I'm reticent to say, though, with the certainty that you have, Bob, that this is a non-issue for every single person in the church. I think there are. And I don't have any evidence of this except for Mike, but I think there are people in the church who do know what the different roles are. I know I did at one point, and I was really interested in, I had a companion on my mission who was of the tribe of Judah, and he was Japanese, and what did that mean? You know, it had all this meaning about the Japanese being the lost tribes of Israel to me.
But it had no meaning, because you can't remember how anything changed. Like, do you have an example of how, did you figure it out?
No. Like if he thought, okay, I have a different role in the church, I don't have to go on a mission because only Ephraim are missionaries, I mean, I don't think that it has that significant of a role, but as far as like his personal view of where he fits in God's plan, I think there's things out there like in the blessing that Jacob gave to each one of his sons, that I think that's Genesis somewhere, that you could go and read what he gave to each one of his sons. So if you're told in your patriarchal blessing that you're Manasseh or Benjamin or Judah, and then you go and you read that, then you've got, okay, this is who I am. This is the special mission. And like, so to think that nobody does that in the church and it has a personal meaning to them, I can imagine that people would, because I know that I did.
No, you're right, Glenn. I remember firmly believing that if anyone who was found to be the tribe of Levi would automatically become bishop. And I don't know where – there must be some source for that, but I remember believing that strongly. So you're right, at least to a degree.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the ultimate goal is to have that patriarchal line and say – because I'm tied to him, like the reason so many people remember the brethren in the early days of the church would be sealed to each other, because if one becomes the great patriarch and is exalted, because if they're tied to him,
gay marriage.
No, yeah. If they're tied to him, at least they get to be a servant in that household. At least it's these family ties and bonds that tie you to a household of exaltation. If you have the name of Christ on you, you get the blessings of Christ. If you get the name of this. You know, the goal is for your family name to be tied to exaltation, and all those tied to you get to go with you.
I'm sorry, I'm siding with Bob here. I've been in ward councils and all that bullshit, and in day to day operations of the church, when you're calling a bishop or you're calling a stake president, do you think they're fucking pulling up their patriarchal blessings to see what tribe they're in?
No, I agree with that.
They're
interviewing
people.
Yeah.
Do you think it'll be good?
But they have the inspiration to know, Randy. I'm surprised you didn't know that.
Okay.
Okay. I think this is just summed up in one sentence, that this is just an outward reflection of a systematic way of everyone getting to think that they're special when they're all the same. That's like all this is. It's just like one big farce. It's like we need a system so that the lowest of the low, the highest of the high, all have a place and are all special. It means nothing, but it just makes
you feel
special.
Yeah, but the system doesn't exist anymore. I mean, okay. And that's what it with
look
this
at it this
policy,
way.
With this essay.
If you want to go to heaven, whose name do you have to have on you?
Joseph Smith's.
Christ. Okay, you have to be baptized into the name of Christ, right? If we're all to be Christ-like, then we should treat our names with the same respect we treat his and have our names mean something and have our family mean something.
You know, Christ
that's the goal.
Christ is a Greek term.
Yeah. So, like, Joseph Smith understood.
So, do you believe this, Mike, really, what you wrote?
Yeah.
No, what right here? So basically, if this is to be accepted, the essay, Revelation has ceased prior to Spencer W. Kimball. Is that, I mean, that's a an if then? Do you stand by that?
I'm saying those that read it on a surface level, that's what you tend to take away. And that is a load of, I don't think, if you read closer, it doesn't say that, but that's the gist if you just read it loosely.
Well, can I get into your mind here, Mike? So at any point prior to you calling all these people and raising a ruckus, did you ever feel like, well, the brethren are on this extraordinary level and I can't criticize them? I mean, there's that clip of Dallin Oaks saying you can't criticize the brethren even if they're wrong. Where did you
14 principles of following the prophet talk?
Where did you decide? You know what? Enough's enough. I'm going to step over the line and I'm going to criticize them. I'm going to go after them and tell them they're wrong on this one.
No, I've read enough biographies and family stories about living with prophets and apostles. They don't claim to be infallible.
No, I mean, we're not talking about infallible though. I feel like that you're using an extreme analogy there. We're talking about close to infallible, or you know, like
they're just perfect.
But at least on the important
at least on this issue,
on the important things, they you know we
at least on exaltation of a race of people.
But my understanding of Mike's position is that he doesn't think that they received wrong revelation or anything like that. It's this committee that wrote it and that they signed off on it, and they don't really understand what they've done.
But, exactly. But he's also, that's how I feel. Yeah. But you're saying that they weren't even inspired when they gave the stamp of approval, right?
Well, it's kind of like when Joseph got the Kinderhook plates. Well, this looks pretty good. Okay, let's you know, on surface level, this looks acceptable. Go with it, you know. But now we find out later that the Kinderhook was bogus, and I'm telling you this essay is bogus.
So, Mike,
so if they clarify this, if the first presidency come out and they clarify and say, nope, we reviewed it, and we actually are now affirming that the first presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve avow that this is what we meant. We really, really, really super tappy 2014 meant it. Then what?
I don't know. I'd have to take it from there.
Hey, Mike, are you familiar with the Proclamation Number 2? Wolf of Woodrow?
Yes.
What does it say?
Well, there's not going to be polygamy anymore.
No, that the Lord will never allow
two. Not one, two. Jesus, don't you know your fucking scriptures?
Easy, Randy, easy.
How often do we reference number two?
Proclamation two, the Lord will never allow his church to be led astray. If so, okay. he will remove.
Right, correct.
Okay, so at what point do you, will you draw the line in the sand where the church is being led astray? If you think a committee is leading the brethren astray, what's next?
Spoiler alert. The committee.
It's just an essay.
Do you believe the church will never be led astray?
Yes. Christ leads his church. These are Christ's apostles. That's one of the things that's upsetting is if these are Christ's apostles today, all the ones prior to 78 were Christ's apostles, hand-chosen then.
Hey,
so hang on a second. I gotta ask this. I know I'm ripping a can of worms open, so let's just cool it before I say this. I'm just saying this is a hypothetical, Mike, so, you know, take a deep breath, brother.
Okay.
Let's just say, hypothetically, that the church okay, they found a way to be okay with homosexuals. Okay.
I thought I already brought this up.
I know, but let's just say hypothetically, I mean, because we're talking about you having problems with what the Brethren approve, Mike. If they did, would your feelings be even more so? Would you make twice as many phone calls? Would you leave the church? I mean, what kind of conflict would be going on in your head there?
It's impossible. It's doctrinally
No. See, you're not entertaining my hypothetical.
So is this.
I don't think he understands the word hypothetical.
So just pretend.
Then you hit your knees and say, please send us a new prophet.
Is that what you'd really say?
Yes.
You'd be like, the church is no longer being led by you, God. We're in apostasy.
But you're not to that point on this one yet, right? This is just an essay. You're saying that this is a problem, but it's not. It's just a sleight of hand or a mistake and a clerical error or, you know, a bad judgment call. It didn't stay on the desk long enough before
somebody got happy. Yeah, somebody got happy with the rubber stamp. Yeah,
I sustain the first presidency in the 12th. I just don't sustain this essay.
Is it because Thomas Monson's senile? Do you think that's how they slipped it past?
No, everybody. You know, I keep hearing rumors like that, and then you see him, and he's just you see him in an interview or up at conference, and he's clear as day. You know.
Who do you think has more authority in the church, Mike, the first presidency, or Curtin McConkie, the church's law firm?
aren't they employed by the first presidency?
Yeah, who do you think has more influence over the church?
That's like saying who has more influence, the cash register guy at the KFC or the manager in the back?
Oh, nice. I like it.
That was pretty good.
So which one is the cash register in the back?
The lawyers are the cash register.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right now, the guy at the cash register, he's running the show.
But if the attorneys write all the policies and all the, you know, and this is the same thing, the PR.
That's just a sad statement of the day, is that when you have a large church that's global and everything can get picked apart, you have a message to get out, but then you have to run it through legal to avoid all the crazy people in the world that want to throw a lawsuit every time they turn their heads. That's just a sad statement of the day.
But between the law firm and these essay writing committee members and the PR firm, where does the first presidency come in?
Well, they direct. I wanted to say this. You put it in legal language, you know.
Oh, that's a problem, isn't it?
Well, that's just a sad state of the affairs.
But is that what they did here, Mike? Except with the lawyers, they did it with the historian, they did it with this committee, and said, "Here's what we want to say. Put it in the proper language, and we'll sign off on it."
They really screwed the language up.
Didn't they commission this?
Yes, they commissioned it.
By the way, for the record, I think Mike is just living in like a pre-correlated state of the church. Like back to Tom's point of like, how can you be challenging? And if you do go back, you know, before David O. McKay, this type of stuff, which doesn't get very much press nowadays because the church has sort of buried it. But if you read real history, I mean, the Brethren and even bishops and stake presidents were challenging each other on fundamentals like this all the time. And, you know, there was even wars at the apostle level. And, you know, just look at evolution as an example. I can't remember the apostle's name on either side, but then one over the other.
V.H. Roberts v. Joseph Fielding Smith.
Yes.
Wasn't Talmage involved in that, too?
Talmage was on
B.H. Roberts' side. But B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith were the two main guys.
That's fun stuff to read, too. That's enthralling.
So, Mike, do you feel like correlation overall has been like a detriment? Because I feel like it's not your style. It's not the church. Like you're really like Mormonism pre-correlation. I don't mean to like put you in a box, but that's kind of how I think of you. And
that's the most exciting books when you go to like, especially in Utah, they have a lot of the bookstores, and you can find some great stuff if it's printed like pre-1950 or 50s and 60s. There's some good stuff, and it's just the simple gospel, and it's exciting. And then you get into correlation, and it's like we have to simplify everything, but also it's almost like
whitewash it.
Be too careful. Hey, did we ever cover, Mike, if this is doctrinal, how do you reconcile Joseph Smith's time and the fact that he did give blacks the priesthood?
You know, Maybe he got a good vibe off of him, and these guys are good, and go with it. They, you know, if the whole point was the cultural aspect, you know, are they living in a culture that the priesthood?
Whoa! Cultural? What?
It's about family. It's about lineage. It's about family.
Right. A family is a culture. Right.
But if there's an exception to the rule, Mike, then there is no rule. Like on this one, you can't look both ways.
Let's touch on this. Why are women veiled?
That's a great question. Why are they?
Okay. Women are veiled.
Because of misogyny.
No, you think about who stands between us and heaven is Christ. Christ stands at the veil. And he has prepared a place, and he is in charge of who gets through into that sacred place. Women are veiled for the same reason in the other direction. They stand between premortal world and our world, and they are in charge of the culture those people enter into.
So where does the veil come in?
What?
That didn't make any sense.
You pass in the veil between the premortal world and the mortal world. We call it the veil of forgetfulness, where we forget the preexistence and or forget like the premortal world.
I understood every one of those words, just not in the order you put them.
Okay, the point is that the women are in charge. The men can seal and bind people in the priesthood all day long, but if the Holy Ghost doesn't ratify the work we do in the priesthood, it's useless. So women create an environment the Holy Ghost can dwell in. That's this whole family line we're talking about, is the families create culture for the Holy Ghost to thrive in so the priesthood can be effective.
So yeah, that's why they hide their faces.
But let's go back to that guy. That guy, you know, Elijah Abel or whomever that we know was given the priesthood. Why the exception? He's still part of that same culture, that lineage that you're talking about.
He's living in Nauvoo among the saints, and he's one of the saints.
Why can't any other black person use the same argument?
Wow. Thank you. No, you know what? I appreciate that, Mike. Thank you for proving our point.
Yeah. Well, what about that Manning lady that was living among the saints in Salt Lake and petitioned to the day she died to just get her endowment?
I'm sure she was first in line after 78, and they ran her through the system.
There's a whole book about her. Brigham was a total dick to her.
Yeah. Joseph Smith was not racist. He was a progressive. For all his foibles, for all his
problems. Don't you foul the name of that great man with calling him a liberal.
Yeah, quit putting him up there.
How dare you, sir.
He was a total liberal. He was about free. He was about.
I said he was progressive. He was not a liberal. He was progressive.
Same poisonous language. How dare you, sir?
Poisonous.
That was pretty good.
I think we beat this one to death.
For how much I despise everything you stand for, I can't help but admire you taking on how many of us? 1, 2, 3, 4 of us?
I hate Mike online. I hate him. I like the guy in person. I'm gonna be honest.
Who doesn't love Mike?
Who doesn't love Mike? It's true.
You're standing in the middle of the ring while four guys are just kicking and beating the shit out of you, and you're just like, yeah, give me more.
And he won't fall down. We're like, what's wrong with this guy? Why does he just fall over?
Except I do agree with him. I agree with his points. I think he's right that it is doctrinal. They can't back off it without just saying amen to the revelation and the priesthood of that man and all those men that came before him.
We'll remember him in your prayers tonight.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Hi, this is Hillary.
Matthew Ryan.
Carol Dashley. And I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give The Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Good to meet you online. I think this is our first time chatting online. It's good to speak with you voice to voice.
You too. Thank you very much.
See you, Mike.
Good night.
Good night.
Hoy.
Wow. What a piece of work. He's got the thickest skin of any human I've ever come across.
Dude, how do you not have respect for the guy making calls saying this is a bunch of garbage? Dude, I don't know. I love it. I think it's
I agree with him. He is right.
Yeah.
He's the only one that has the balls to say, come on now, let's embrace the doctrine. It's the same way with people did it with polygamy too, right? How dare you remove it?
You know who else was like that? Hitler. He really believed in his principles of ridding the world of the evil Jews.
The lowest common denominator.
Oh my God! How
But how committed was he to his vision? He was so committed. Nobody could knock him off his track.
No.
And I got to admire the guy for that.
Hitler-sized balls, man. That guy had balls.
Well, that, and, you know, this is the first time that this whole servant thing kind of struck with me, with the, that they become servants. But
that's not,
this feels like child's play to me. I've gone round and round with him with the homosexual thing. And that is so much more egregious, man. Mike.
It is, but he is right.
Swinging.
But he is right that he has at least some foundations in scripture on that. And so as long as you come from that premise,
Leviticus?
Have
Leviticus? Yeah. Got Leviticus? Jesus didn't say jack shit about homosexuals.
Yeah, there's
he actually was pro-slavery. That's very clear. But Jesus didn't say shit about homosexuality. You got to go all the way back to Leviticus to get anything on that.
Oh, and if they stand on Leviticus, I mean, talk about a cherry picking the Old Testament.
Oh, my God, totally. Horrible. Just read the 10 verses before and the 10 verses after and live by that.
Right, but the problem is even if Jesus came out and said the same thing, as if that would be any more authoritative, I don't care.
I'm just saying he doesn't have a ton. There's not a ton of stuff to back up anti-gay rhetoric. There's not. The Bible says almost nothing about it.
Right, except the brethren have, and they haven't backed off that one. So he can certainly pull out every quote and statement of the modern era leaders as well. So that one we come from fundamental places of what we find persuasive.
Yeah. How many verses in the Book of Mormon about homosexuality? None.
Less than one.
Nephi was a little gay.
He was a little gay.
Ha! Gay!
Yeah, I saw the movie.
I'm trying to think, having been raised of fabulous parents. But never mind.
Fabulous.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.